question than it is in first and second declension, and that will tell you for sure. Because there's enough variations in the forms of third declension nouns, there's a reason to stick this in here. So this one tells you the declension. Now, with the information that you have so far, you can pretty much get along with just the nominative singular form. That's going to pretty well, between first and second declension, is going to pretty well uniquely determine it. But in the future, we're going to need to have this genitive singular form to really nail it down. Okay, and then after the comma, this is the article that goes with it. The form of the article. So it's ho elenchos. Now, what is that article? What is that going to tell you about the noun? Yeah, it's going to tell you it's masculine. Okay, well, let me just put it in general. It determines the gender. So in the dictionary form, they're giving you information that will determine the declension for you and information that will determine the gender. And it's the article you're going to look at to determine the gender, and it's the gender singular form later, at least later on, that you're going to look at to determine the declension uniquely. So that's the way nouns are recorded. And every noun that you'll see is recorded this way. Now you're going to see a different genitive singular ending for different nouns, of course. If it's a feminine first declension noun, it'll generally be eta sigma or alpha sigma that you'll see over here. And when we get into third declensions, you'll see other types of things here. You'll see omicron sigmas here sometimes and so forth. We'll get into those things later on. But this genitive singular will determine the declension for you. And then this will determine the gender. Okay, let's look at another example here. Okay. How would I pronounce that word, first of all? Epitage, yes. Okay, and this is the genitive singular form. And we haven't really looked enough at genitive, so later on we'll call more attention to this. But this will determine that this is a first declension noun for you, unambiguously. And then this article here, what does that determine about
it?
Yeah, it's feminine. Okay, hey is the feminine form of the article. And so, looking at this hey, regardless of what these endings are, looking at this hey, we can determine that this is a feminine noun. And looking at this, we can tell it's first declension. But all you need to do for right now is to look at this, and you can tell it's first declension. All you've got to worry about is first and second declension. And between first and second declension, you can tell by this nominative ending, which it is. But when, it's only when you get to third declension that you have any problem. Okay, here's another example. One we've had. Okay, mathetes has got the omicron upsilon. This is the genitive singular form on this one, but you don't need to memorize that yet. We haven't got the genitive forms. But then the article here, the eta sigma here is going to tell us, so, since the only thing so far we've seen like that is the first declension masculine. We know it's first declension, and then if there's any doubt about this being masculine, that's resolved by this article over here. Homathetes. And then hodos. Use the accent. Ooh. Hey. Now this one, the omicron sigma here, plus this information, the genitive singular ending, determines that it is a second declension noun. But over here, the article hey tells us it's a second declension feminine. So with this information, you can construct the entire paradigm for hodos, the article and all of the endings. Okay? And then to look at a neuter here, neuter second declension. How did I pronounce that? Yeah, crospedone. Crospedone. Okay. Now the paradigm is going to look like this. This is the genitive singular form. This is why I said before that this is a second declension neuter. even though the nominative and the accusative forms don't look like the second declension forms like for alien close, the genitive singular form is u. But to here determines that it's neuter, and then the omicron nu determines it's second declension. And this is what really tells you, these two pieces of information together tell you for sure. Okay, that's what you're going to see then in dictionary form and nouns. Glenn?
Should there not be a circumflex over the omicron epsilon like there was on
the others? Yes, not on this one. It's because the accent is over here in the beginning syllable. What will happen in the genitive is that there'll be a circumflex on the genitive. If there was an acute in the nominative forms, that'll turn to a circumflex in the last syllable. There's a rule it's going to cover later on, but this has got the accent two syllables before the end of the word. We call it propriotonic accent, and that means there's no accent in that last syllable. Don't worry about that yet. For now, you don't even need to look so much at the accents when you're looking at the dictionary forms. Just get the word itself down. And this the deals on these accents have to do with where the accent fell originally. And it changes when you get the genitive and dative, but sometimes it can only change so much depending on the word. Okay? Any other questions now about the test coming up? The test will cover chapters 1 through 6 plus this information that I've given you on the board. Now, I'm not going to expect you to know genitive singular endings for any of these, so don't worry about that. I just put this information on dictionary form for your own benefit for right now when you're looking things up and you're wondering what that funny thing in the middle is there. That's the genitive singular ending. Okay. Jim, you had a question about Concord and government, didn't you? Okay. Do you have any way to put your question more specific so I can zero in on exactly what it is? Okay.
You mentioned first 1 through 5.
Mm-hmm.
In English, what was Concord and what was
Gilbert? Right.
And if in English, I had a little bit of trouble.
Okay. Are you having as much trouble in Greek as you're having in English? Or do you know? Okay. Yeah. Well, that stands to reason. Greek's a little bit easier in these respects. Let's first of all define government concord, and then we'll look at the specifics again. The grammatical device of government is one that generally uses inflectional endings to determine the function of a word within the sentence structure. So it will determine things like whether a word is a subject or an object, this type of thing, within the sentence, or whether it's the object of a prepositional phrase or whatever. Whereas concord, and many of these rules overlap, but concord is dealing specifically with words matching other words within the context. In other words, having some sort of ending that will agree with, so you get the idea of agreement with concord, that will agree with some other word. For example, concord is seen when the verb form is going to agree with the subject in number, in English now, for example. So, In English, lots of times we don't have a lot of inflection, so you may not even notice a lot of difference. But he gives a few examples in the exercises where you do. And I don't have my workbook here in front of me right now, but maybe we can just review those exercises. Someone have a copy there?
Thanks, Quinn.
In lesson 4, exercise 4A, says, I don't like those kind of apples. Okay, what is our problem here? Is it government or concord? I don't like those kind of apples. Okay, it's concord here. It's concord. You need to either say this kind of apples or those kinds of apples. But the problem here is an agreement between the adjective, demonstrative adjective, those, and the noun kind. Now, in English, if the adjective form varies like it does with the demonstrative adjective, not some adjectives won't, but if the form will vary, you're going to have to pick the right form to agree with the kind of noun that you've got. So we've got those, and those is used for the plural nouns, and this is used for a singular noun, or these, or whatever, for close part. We've got this and that.
And I guess what we'd really want is that kind of apples here if we're going to go singular. And so we'll have a different form that will inflect for the kind of word that is being used with. So we have to have an agreement there. And we're either going to have to change this to I don't like those kinds of apples, using kinds plural, so that we wouldn't get agreement, or we have to change it to I don't like that kind of apples, to put it in the singular, the demonstrative in singular. So it simply has to do with the way that several words have to agree with one another. There's rules on that. Okay? Between you and I think he's crazy. Okay, now here's a problem. Not of concord, because the I isn't really agreeing with anything, but it's a problem of government, because what we've done here is use the nominative form rather than the accusative form, or a form that would be appropriate for a prepositional phrase in English. So we should be saying between you and me, I think he's crazy, rather than between you and I. This is a government problem, because when we put I there, this personal pronoun has several different forms. And the I form is the form that's used when it's the subject of a sentence. But when it's not the subject of a sentence, when it's the direct object of the sentence, or when it's an indirect object, or when it's in the object of a preposition, it'll be the form me. And that's what it is here, the object of a preposition. Yes?
In concord in English, I was trying to think of what other besides the number has to be in concord.
I don't know if there's too much more in English besides number on verb forms and so forth. There is person involved in verbs. And then pronouns, the main thing for concord, I think, is only number, because government is what gets involved. See, here, this is a government problem. So there's both government and concord. Anybody think of anything else, Mike?
I just had a note for yeah. helping here.
Mm-hmm.
One way to think about it, these terms are somewhat ambiguous. If you think of a possible analogy, the government is kind of that, you think of kind of the federal government, it dictates the general,
mm-hmm.
and concord is like the local government,
mm-hmm.
it dictates the specific
mm-hmm.
elements.
That's a pretty fair analysis of it, because, again, with government, you're dealing with the functions within a whole sentence structure, whereas in concord, you're dealing with more of a localized function in relationship to another word, usually. Sometimes you'll have several different words that are, you know, grouped together, especially when you get to Greek. But in English, it's, you know, especially, it's really local. And Greek too, is local versus more of the general. That might help a little bit. Yes?
What would you call the I, me, or the who?
That would be, the I versus me, or who versus whom, would be a case of government. Government, because it's determining how that is functioning in the sentence, whether it's analogous to in Greek. In fact, some feel that those variations are carryovers from case distinctions from the Germanic languages and so forth, which use those. So it's analogous to whether it's nominative or accusative in Greek, and that would be a function of your government. Okay? Me wants a new toy. Okay, you've got both government and concord problems there. Or what's the government problem in that? Me wants a new toy. What's the government problem? What word's problem there?
Me.
Me, yeah. Again, because we want that to be the subject of the sentence, that's going to have to be the I form. And then the wants is another problem. That's a concord problem, because there we've got the wrong form of the verb, and we need that to agree with the subject. Since it's a first person singular subject, we need the form of the verb that's appropriate to first person singular. Okay? This is a third person singular form of the verb that we've got here with the S on the end, and that won't work. So there's another case in which concord is involved. The verb must agree with its noun in person and number in English. And in Greek we'll find it's person and number also. In Hebrew it's person, number, and gender in some cases. Okay?
Right now, we really have is the number,
mm-hmm.
and then we'll be adding on the adjective.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be concord.
Yeah, when we add the adjectives to nouns, we're going to find the adjectives will have to agree with our noun in number and gender, and so the genders are going to, you know, the adjective just like the article. So it's going to be case, number, and gender, all three.
And then the verbs will be similar.
Verbs will be basically person and number. But then there's other information also on verbs that deals with tense and other things too. But that's not so much governed by Concord. But the Concord rule is going to affect the person and number. Person by person, I mean first, second, or third person. Whether it's you, or the, or he, and then the plural we, you plural, or they. So we'll have six forms in the Greek verb that take care of person and number. And then, of course, there's a whole other variables dealing with the tense and so forth. Okay? We've got mood, voice, and tense in addition to that. So you can see how many different forms of the verb we're going to run into already. And then when you can get into tense, you've got aorist and imperfect and perfects and pluperfects and futures. And then we've got active versus passive also to deal with. Well, that's why if you've seen that chart of the paradigm of the me conjugation, that's why all those forms are there. So we'll get to that in due time, sufficient for the days of evil or other. All right? We'll build that up slowly. Don't think we're going to just jump into all of that once. We'll take each form step by step. And notice the once you get the keys to what makes the difference between them, there's oftentimes very, you know, little changes in fixes and so forth, and after a while you start seeing the patterns, you will find yourself recognizing those forms very easily. Past tense forms, they've got a little epsilon out in front. So that's real easy. You can tell what you're looking at. And so there's lots of nice little keys for determining those things. Even if, say, I don't expect you 2 or 3, 4 years from now to still be able to write down the entire paradigm of the Greek verb, not unless you're sitting there every day and going over it again. But when you're reading your Greek text, you'll be able to recognize. You'll recognize pluperfects. You'll recognize perfects. You'll recognize all these different forms and be able to tell exactly what they are. You'll be able to tell person number. You'll be able to sit down and write a complete parsing of that particular verb form, probably without even having to remember what the paradigms are. Okay? Any other questions on this idea of government concord?
So concord is kind of a local thing. Oh, excuse me. Government's a local rule that determines how words within a phrase are joined together to function as one unit. And this especially is true of the adjective with the noun, demonstrative adjectives and other things with their nouns. It's true of series of adjectives tied together with nouns. You'll see the same, in Greek especially, you'll see the same types of endings in all the adjectives. You'll know they all go with the same noun. It's true of verbs with their subjects. And that's primarily what we're dealing with. Now, the government rule deals with, in Greek, deals with whether something's nominative, genitive, dative, or accusative, depending on whether it's a subject, the object, indirect object, or object of a prepositional phrase in Greek. And when we get to prepositions, we'll see that prepositions are said to govern certain cases, meaning that when you use a certain preposition, then when you put the noun in that prepositional phrase, that noun is going to have a certain case, because the rule says that this governs a certain case. So it's a case of government. Yes, Jim?
Would it be fair to say that government is more of a more syntactically impacting? Concord is more philosophical?
Well, the Concord, is at least as far as the obvious distinctions, when your eyeball catches up, right, catches first, it would seem to follow that. However, there are some very important syntactic aspects to this Concord rule, because what they do is tell you what words in the sentence function together. And they will also tell you, especially later on when we get to relative clauses and so forth, they'll tell you what a relative pronoun's antecedent is. And that is a very important syntactic aspect. So I don't know, I think they're really both syntactic. But the focus of the Concord is a little bit more local. It's not so impacting in the sense of determining the whole structure of the sentence. But it will be impacting and determining how that particular part of the sentence is functioning and what words in that sentence go together.
Mm-hmm. What I was thinking of was Concord seems to have either a labeling function like you just mentioned,
mm-hmm.
or just a more of a technical agreement type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas government is more root level of what is your direct object, how are you constructing
it. Right. Yeah, if you want to make it in that sense, a distinction in that sense, it's fine. But both of them are really dealing with syntax. Yeah, one more of a local level, one more of a general level, I suppose, to bring up the distinction Mike made earlier. And so these rules are very, very important. And for example, when you're dealing with a verb form in a Greek sentence, There may be cases, for example, where you have both the subject and the direct object are neuter nouns. You might have cases in which they're both neuter nouns. And there may be a question as to which one of them is the subject of the sentence, which one is the object. But suppose one of them is plural and one of them is singular. They're both neuter, but one of them is plural and one of them is singular. Well, then if you look at your verb form, the verb form will either be a plural form or a singular form. And that will determine which of those two was the subject and the object. Because remember, in the neuter, the accusative forms and the nominative forms are the same. So you can't tell just by looking at the inflections which is which. And so there's a case in which your Concord rule is determining your government situation. It doesn't happen too often, but it can happen, where because of the rule of Concord between the verb and the subject of the verb, then if the verb is a singular verb form, you'll know that the singular neuter noun was the subject and the plural neuter noun is the object. If the verb form was plural, then you know that the plural neuter noun was the subject and the singular one was the object. So there's a case in which that Concord rule may be able to be the thing that tips the scale and determines which government rule is in effect. Okay, so there is an interplay between those in some potential situations. That's not going to be happening all the time by any means. It's not very commonly that you get two neuter nouns, for example, in the same sentence structure, both in accusative and nominative positions. But when that happens, of course, then that can help. Now, of course, if both nouns are neuter, both of them are singular, then the verb form isn't going to tell you either. You're going to have to go by context. Okay? Any other questions? Speak now, forever hold your peace. Yes. On anything in chapters 1 to 6, or anything we've really covered so far. Confine it to Greek, at least, yeah.
I'd like a little bit more explanation on the exercise 6C that we worked on.
Mm-hmm.
One reason I'm not able to be able to determine why there's only one answer for each section.
Okay.
If you're looking just at the ending,
I'll have to look at this.
You know, it seems like they should be able to take a couple of answers.
6B is the one you have a problem with? Okay. Well, let's just look at them here.
Is there some way you could clarify that for me?
Okay. Maybe what I'll do, would it help if I went through each choice and showed you why it's wrong, the other ones, why it can't be, and then show you why the one has to be? That's what you're looking for, isn't it?
You can do that again when you did it the first time.
Yeah.
And I didn't catch
it. Okay, well, listen.
My answer was right. I thought what you said, why the wrong answer is wrong, but I couldn't.
Oh, you couldn't see what the right answer is, right.
I didn't know why the wrong answer is wrong, but.
Okay.
I can't even prove my what I wrote down.
Okay. All right, sentence number one. Tone blank agapavo theos. Now, what you really need to do here is look at the whole sentence structure. Ho theos is nominative form. So that's going to be the subject. And we see the article tone there. And the only thing we've seen so far with the article tone, remember the paradigm of the article, the only place where the article tone comes in is in a masculine, accusative, singular. If you look at your paradigm, that's the only place you'll have it. So you know then that what we're looking for is a noun that's masculine, accusative, singular. Now, you can't determine that only by looking at these words here. You have to know from your vocabulary list what their genders are in order to see where they're going to fit. In other words, you're not expected just to be able to, out of the air, figure out what these are. See, for example, if you'd never seen the word technon or doulon before and didn't know what the article that went with them was, the gender was, then technon and doulon could both fit into that frame. I mean, if there was a word technos, for example, that was a second declension masculine noun, there isn't. But if there was, that technon could fit in. But that technon, see, the noun, to technon, is a neuter noun. And knowing that it's neuter, we have to say, no, it can't fit in here, because if to technon was a noun that we need, the article would be to, not tone. So the article being tone shows you it's got to be a masculine accusative singular form. So doulon's the only one that fits. Doulon's the only one that's got, all of these are accusative forms. They're all accusative singular forms, all four of these. But technon doesn't work because it's neuter. Ampelon doesn't work. Why? It's feminine. Yeah, it's hey ampelos. Now, if you didn't know that it was hey ampelos, then you you know, from the information you've got, you would think that that would fit too. It is second declension, but it's a second declension feminine. And then Cheiron is the first declension, so that's not going to fit, and it's also feminine. So, by elimination then, the only one that fits, the only one that's a masculine second declension accusative is Dulong. So that's the only one that can fit the blank. The rest of them are a problem because of the gender. And that's basically the situation in all these, yes?
Well, Cheiron had been a masculine first declension, if it still
was. Right, it could be if it was a masculine first declension. That's a good point. So, for example, if it was, well, yes, you wouldn't, there, like if it was Neoneos, Neoneos is a masculine, Neoneos, I guess, then you could have Neone on there. You could have something ending in off anew, and it could be, just looking at this word, if you've never seen it before, it's potentially possible that it could be an alpha-type first declension masculine. But because you know from the vocabulary, again, that the article given with it is Hechera, that's what tells you. Okay? Good. Anyone else? All right. Then number two, tus, agapa, tus blank agapaho theos. Well, you see, tus is, again, from your paradigm of the article, it's the form that's going to be used on a masculine, plural, accusative noun. So what we're looking for is a masculine plural accusative. And psukas doesn't work because it's hey psuke, and that's feminine. Tekna doesn't work because that's ta tekna, that's neuter plural. So the gender's no good there. They're both accusative plurals, but they're the wrong gender. Ampelus doesn't work because it's hey ampelos, and it's feminine. So mathetas is the only one that works, because mathetas is a first declension, but it is a masculine first declension. And the masculine plural accusative form of the article is tus, whereas the masculine plural accusative form, in this particular declension is mathetas. So this does fit. This one will work. Okay, same ta, tekna, agapa, hotheos. Tekna is the right answer that fits in there. What you need here is a neuter plural, and it's accusative neuter plural form. Because you can only tell it's accusative by the fact that it's hotheos and that the verb form is agapa, singular form. You don't know that part yet, but you can tell from the hotheos. And so you need something plural, so tekna is the only one that fits. Chera doesn't fit because that's a singular form, and it's also feminine. And ampelon doesn't fit because that's an accusative form. That's okay, but it's singular, and it's a feminine noun. And suke, again, that's a nominative form. And so that wouldn't fit on that basis, and it's also feminine. Okay, then teen blank agapaho theos, that's ampelon. That's the only one that's going to fit because you're looking for a feminine. And mathetin, dulon, and tekna, mathetin and dulon are both masculine. Tekna is neuter, and so ampelon is the only one that you know that will fit. But again, you have to know what the article that goes with that noun is. You have to know the vocabulary in order to do this exercise. You can't do it just by looking at the forms. Okay? Good. Does that clarify it?
Yeah, that helps, because I tried to do this and without looking for this on the page.
Yeah.
Before.
There's no way you can do it, because
I looked at the ending and matched it up to what I was looking at.
Sure.
I still couldn't see which way it went.
And see, the point is that he's purposely giving you examples where the endings don't rhyme. See? Yes?
Are we responsible for any certain vocabulary from your parents?
No, not any vocabulary I'll give you. We haven't had our vocabulary quiz yet. I'm going to give you a list of vocabulary words coming up. But you're responsible to know how to read that Greek word, as it were. But I'll give you any information you'll need. I'll give you the articles and so forth that are appropriate and so forth. So I'm not going to be asking you to... You won't be dependent upon anything. I'll give you forms and with an article and the noun, but they'll be definitive enough for you to be able to tell without ever knowing the meaning of the noun, whether it's masculine, feminine, or neuter, whether it's first or second declension.
Yeah.
Okay? Question back there?
In the second declension,
yes, there's no difference whatsoever in the endings in the second declension, masculines and feminines. There is for neuters. Neuters have a little bit different endings, but masculines and feminines have absolutely no difference. Hehodos and hotheos are exactly the same in all the paradigms, including the genitive and dative. There's no differences there either. So they're just the same. The only way you're going to be able to tell them is by the article.
And you said that if a stem ends in a low or a vowel,
yes,
that's an A-O-U-R.
No, it will apply to all the singulars, actually. We haven't got the full paradigm, but it'll apply to the nominative and accusative singular. And but it doesn't apply to the plurals, because the plurals get alpha types regardless of whether they're aetas or alpha.
But only in the feminine.
Right, only in the feminine. Well, I don't want to say only in the feminine, in the first declension. There are some first declension masculines that he hasn't really confronted us with in the book yet. But like Mathe Tace, there are some. There's very few of them. But there are a few. I don't know, they probably can count them on the fingers of one hand for the total ones that we're going to run into in the New Testament. But there are a few that have, in the first declension masculines, also this same feature of going to alpha because the stem ends in a row or a vowel. So I just kind of note that as a sidelight. There's not very many of them, but they will happen. The majority of them, ones you already see, of course, are in the feminine. That's why I put on the board. Yes, go ahead. What was that?
That's only a first declension.
Right. It's only a first declension characteristic. Your second declension doesn't do anything like that. You have one consistent thematic vowel in the second declension, and that's your omicron. And the third declension doesn't do that. It does some other things, but it doesn't do that. Okay. It's the problem in third declension has to do with the fact that some of the endings are consonant rather than vowel. And when you add some consonants onto other consonants, they don't like, the sounds don't sound good, so they make some changes. And that's why you get some of the variation. We will learn certain rules for how that works, and then it's not so mysterious. But we'll do that in due time. The third declension is usually held off in most of the textbooks until after you've mastered the first and second declensions. And that's what we'll do here. It's not all that hard in itself, but it's more difficult at first and second. Was there another question? Yes. Yes. Yeah, you could speak it and not even know what a declension was, you know. You just know what the right word is in every place. Okay. Any other questions before we look at chapter 7 some more?
On the, the syntactical and distributional
Yes.
methods of telling whether a word is noun or not.
Uh-huh.
Are you going to do like you did in the book and do it, or are we going to be requirements for that?
Well, I'll guarantee you there'll be a question about it on the test. I can't tell you exactly what the format of it is. I expect you to just know the basic distinction between these two. I'm just kind of looking mainly for a definition. In other words, if I were to ask you for what constitutes an inflectional or paradigmatic definition for grammatical categories, I expect you to say something like it's determined by the fact that certain words can take certain endings, unlike other words can take, and they fit into certain paradigms with certain inflections, and those inflections will often determine what kind of a word it is just by looking what the inflections are. That's basically all I'm interested in. And for the syntactic or distributional law, what I'm interested in is a word that can fit a certain frame within the language structure. And nouns are, you know, you could even get an example or something. A noun is a word that fits into this particular frame. You can do that if you want, but I'm not gonna hold you responsible for being able to literally put down the frames that he puts here. All I'm interested in is that you have the concept that the distributional type of definition has to do with the kinds of positions that words can fill within the sentence structures. And that's all I'm interested in, is that basic concept. Okay. All right, anyone else? Give you one last opportunity here. Okay, let's take a look at lesson 7. We left off just at the beginning of that last time, and we can proceed a little bit further here. There won't be any assignment for next Tuesday except for the test, so even if we get through this, I don't think we will, but even if we get through the chapter, we won't do the exercises until after the test. Chapter 7 is dealing with subject and object. The first thing he did on the first page here that we got to last time was give a number of examples, 11 different examples of sentences in English, pointing out several different features. There's quite a few different types of sentences here, but one thing in common here, and the word that you see in boldface in all of these examples, is the subject of the sentence. But as we noticed as we went through these, the subject of a sentence doesn't always mean the one who performs the action. In some cases, it's the one who receives the action. In some cases, it's the one which is described. In other cases, it's the one which is identified. In some cases, it's the one to or for whom the action is performed. Almost an indirect object type of an idea, at least, as far as meaning. Sentence 10, the dog was given a bone by the child. In the last example, we have that a situation in which the subject both performs the action and receives the action. In other words, it's a reflexive idea where he's doing the action to himself. Or at least sometimes it's not directly doing it to yourself, but it's doing something that is having its benefit for yourself. And so the professor bathed hastily. The word bathed in English, just the meaning of the verb, has got a very much like a middle voice idea. Now, we haven't covered middle voice yet. We will be getting to that later on in Greek. But we'll find in the Greek they have a separate set of verb forms to indicate these kinds of meanings, reflexive meanings or meanings that involve a person doing something for self-interest. And that's what we've seen here. We have the same thing in English. We just don't do it with a separate verb form. It's usually contained in the meanings of the verbs or in certain auxiliary words that we associate with it. So we get that kind of a meaning. But it's not nearly as common an idea as it is in Greek. Okay, now, section 46. In each of these 11 sentences, the position of the boldface word marks it as the subject. So what he's saying is it's not the real meaning of that word in the sentence, it's the position of the word that's determining that's the subject. We're all picking up on the fact that it's the first noun in the sentence. That's what's telling us that it's the subject. It's not because it's the performer of the action, because in some cases it's the receiving of the action. Some cases it's like an indirect object in the sense of the action is performed for its benefit or it's being identified or something. There's a lot of different types of structures. But in every case, it's the word order, the position in the sentence that's determining whether it's the subject. In other types of sentences, other positions serve to mark the subject. So these were simple declarative sentences. Now if we look at, say, interrogative sentences or questions, we're going to find that there will be a consistent pattern here also, but it will be a different pattern of word order than we saw before. Thus, the interrogative sentences corresponding to those in the preceding page have a different but still constant characteristic pattern. So we have sentence 1 prime here, did the treasurer misappropriate the funds? Did the treasurer misappropriate the funds? Number 2, did the judge cough apologetically? Number 3, did the child give the dog a bone? Number 4, did the general call the captain a fool? Number 5, is his wife a vegetarian? Number 6, is this room stuffy? Number 7, were the funds misappropriated by the treasurer? Number 8, was a bone given the dog by the child? Number 9, was the captain called a fool by the general? Number 10, was the dog given a bone by the child? Did the professor bathe hastily? Now, what would you be able to say about the specific change in word order that's occurred here? What is the difference between the pattern here and the pattern in the previous sentences? And that marks the subject. Yes.
The verb,
yes, the verb, instead of coming after the subject, is coming before the subject. Sometimes it's not the whole verb. In cases where some of them are going to use an auxiliary verb, did, instead of saying misappropriated the treasurer of the funds, so oftentimes words that are big verbs like that, big long, we'll use this auxiliary word instead. We'll say did the treasurer misappropriate the funds. But like, is his wife a vegetarian? The sentence started out, his wife is a vegetarian. Now it's we just took the verb and stuck it out in the front and then put the subject afterwards. That's a very common word order pattern in English to indicate a question, changing the word order, putting the verb first, then the subject. But in again, you can see there's a consistent pattern. You've got a verb form or auxiliary verb form as the first position in the sentence, or there's a couple that don't follow that pattern. Sentences 7, 8, 9, 10. What's the feature there? The verb form isn't stuck out in the front. No, I guess it is. It is in all these. There are other question words where you get who, what, when, where, and how, and so forth. That's a little bit different sentence structure. Okay, these are fine. Okay. Now, section 47, the boldface words in all sentences are in subject positions. Their status as subject is thus in English structurally defined. However, the structural meanings which are expressed by these subjects are not all the same. In order to be able to distinguish among these, we must be able to recognize still other characteristics of the different sentence structures. In other words, his point is this. we recognize that these are all subjects, but we also recognize, especially as we did on the previous page where he stated what the function was, that the subject had a different function in many of these different types of sentences. Sometimes the subject was the performer of the action. Sometimes the subject was the receiver of the action if it was a passive construction. Sometimes the subject was both the performer and the receiver of the action. Sometimes the subject is the one that's being identified. Sometimes it's the one that's being described. A number of different types of things that a subject can be. And the thing that is determining those meanings for us is are other features of the sentence in addition to that position, because the position is common to all of these. So the thing that's telling you the specific meaning of the subject in a given sentence is other features of the sentence structure. Features like whether the verb is passive or active, and other word order features of the rest of the elements in the sentence, and the kind of a verb it is, whether the verb is transitive or intransitive. That's going to come up a little bit later in this chapter. In other words, whether the verb is a verb that can take a direct object or not. Whether the verb is an equative verb, like the verb to be. That's got a certain functional meaning, and that determines to a large extent how the subject is acting in the sentence and how it's transmitting meaning. Okay, when taken together, these formal structural characteristics rarely leave us in doubt as to which of the possible meanings is actually intended in a given instance. As native speakers of English, we recognize and react to these various structural signals quite unconsciously. It would not be easy for us to describe them in detail. Yes?
They're using this example of English because it's a very definite structure, but I think I found an example where it violates his rules he's putting up for English.
Oh, okay.
Where you can take the subject and the verb and put the end of the sentence like, bitten by the dog he was.
Uh-huh.
And he was, is still the subject, even though it's right at the end of the sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was thinking, I was looking at almost all of these examples. Some of them, they come out rather
mm-hmm.
awkward, but
yes.
In every case, you can put the subject at the end of the sentence and still keep the sentence
mm-hmm.
just by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You take that apologetically to Judge Cox,
mm-hmm.
or call the captain by the fool the general was, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In every case, it's not in front of the sentence anymore,
mm-hmm.
but it's still the subject.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to his English structure?
Well, you've got a good point there, because most of the examples you give, though, are not, those are usually the kinds of things you'll see in poetry and in things where you're trying to put special emphasis on, and especially in older English you see that. Apparently, there's some evidence here that older English was a little bit more fluid in this respect. And the word order wasn't quite as rigid. And of course, it's not all that rigid now, but you know when a person talks that way, he's talking from a little bit different realm, you know. If somebody comes up to you and says, you know, bitten by the dog he was, there's several things going through your mind. You're saying, is this person a foreigner who's just learned English, and his word order isn't quite as normal? You can understand it, and it would be grammatically correct, you know, in a prose type of situation if you were, you know, relating how a person was talking and so forth. But if you did everything that way all throughout a technical report or something, you know, people are going to question whether, you know, you're really speaking proper English or not. So it's not a real hard and fast rule, an ironclad type of thing. However, even there, there are some important things as far as specific word order that could change the whole picture. If you reverse the position, say, of an object and a subject, you'll get a different meaning. The man bit the dog versus the dog bit the man. You see? That's a completely different meaning, just by reversing those terms. Yet, you could say the man bit the dog, let's see, you'd have to put it in a passive construction there. The dog the man bit, or something like that, you could say. But that's a little bit, awkward. Nevertheless, you can get the meaning from it. But again, it's because the verb has still followed the subject. Even though you've switched those things around, you put the object out here, you still got the verb joined to the subject. And you could even sometimes...
So in English, regardless of any other structure, the act of verb immediately
uh-huh.
follows the subject.
Well, again, I just thought of an example where you have to really strain it. You have to really strain it. But let's see...
All we're proving is that there aren't thousands of the rules.
Right.
But
yeah.
We're really proving that the rules are
pretty solid,
because
yeah.
our examples are so strange we can hardly understand.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. We're straining it. And he is setting up this. What he's doing here with English is primarily trying to set you up for Greek. So he's not necessarily trying to be so rigid with English to say there's no exceptions to this, but in normal English, these are patterns that were given. Now, actually, what we might say is not that the others were exceptions, but that they would be less frequently used patterns that are recognizable in the English structure that would convey meaning. So you could define it that way, I suppose, and weasel your way out of it, I suppose. But I'm glad you know that we're making some observations here that we can see that it helps us to see what the nature of our language is and what things we are picking up on and what things we are discerning meaning from. But you can see that you can only go so far with stretching things before the thing just it doesn't mean anything at all. Once you start breaking up the verb with the subject type of thing, certain word order features, you'll either change the meaning entirely or you'll result with no meaning, like, giver, God, cheerful, loves, A, or something. Okay?
Would that, to a lesser extent, apply to all of his permutations of word order in the Greek sentence?
Yes, I think so. See, within the Greek structure, it's mainly a matter of emphasis, and that's kind of what happens here. When you, in poetry or something like that, where you want to really emphasize something, and put things in a little bit different order, maybe start out with a direct object or something like this, it definitely has a certain emphatic value in English. And in Greek, though, I would say it's the same kind of thing. Only in Greek, you don't have any real strong conventions for establishing your word order in any particular pattern. And so it's much more fluid, but nevertheless it functions to transmit some emphatic meanings that wouldn't have been there otherwise. By changing the word order, putting a direct object first or something like this, you get a little bit more emphasis on it. Just that they're doing it all the time. And we just do it sometimes. And they don't have any kind of real rigid structure as far as the word order patterns in a sentence that we do, or any commonly used pattern. If you start reading through Greek, you'll find that you won't be able to. It's not a matter of saying most of the time in Greek the subject first, then the verb. That's not the case at all. It's not most of the time. It's just kind of, each sentence is almost different in that respect. And
another example is the dog and the man.
Mm-hmm.
You would say the man, the dog, did.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think we would probably most often understand that as the man is the subject, mm-hmm. and the dog, even though the dog is
mm-hmm.
perceiving the verb.
Yes.
But
it could be
right in that front
mm-hmm.
subject position. So you got like two positions there that grapple with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that one could go either way, just depending on how you put the intonation. And even with the intonation put, a person could misunderstand it. So that's one of the reasons. See, what's happening is we're kind of breaking down our normal grammatical cues, and it's generating ambiguity. And sometimes for the purposes of humor or for the purposes of a clever trick in a literary narrative or something, they'll do that. And so those are the kinds of, poetic license that people can take with the language and still transmit meaning, but open up some options and so forth. So it's kind of interesting. It's interesting to look at this strange thing we call language, to see what we're really getting, and what kind of meanings we're getting. Greek is easier, though, in this respect, because the grammatical devices seem to be a lot more regular and consistent. You don't have a lot of... there will be differences in emphasis, but those will be easy to discern. Okay, next time, then, we will take our little test. I don't know if it'll take the whole hour. I don't think so, but we'll take as long as you need. Right.
Another way to get away with that in Greek is
to involve neuter. Right, exactly. Yeah, in Greek, they have to be both neuter to have the ambiguity of subject versus object. But in any other nouns, you're going to have it nailed down by the case function. That's right. Well, it's a different kind, let's put it that way. Different kind. Hebrew, though, you can get away with a lot more of that. A lot more of that ambiguity factor comes in Hebrew, more so than in English. Yeah.